Docket is Sylvester Matthew Cheatham versus Commonwealth. Morning, Mr. Davies. How are you?
Morning. How are y'all?
Fine, thank you. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
All right, you have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Brindley Davies. I represent Sylvester Matthew Cheatham in this case. I would submit respectfully that the trial court erred, as you see in my brief, in two areas. One, in refusing to instruct the jury on the theory of self-defense because there is more than a scintilla of evidence presented that the defendant acted under reasonable apprehension of death or great bodily injury, and that they erred in permitting the Commonwealth to ask leading questions to Joanne Bennett during direct examination about material issues crucial to the Commonwealth's case because, and specifically because those questions were prejudicial to the defendant. So beginning with the first error, and as the court is aware, the standard of review, appellate court considers the evidence in the light most favorable to the proponent of the jury instruction. In this case, if there's evidence in the record to support the defendant's theory of defense, the trial judge may not refuse to grant a proper proffered instruction. Those are both from Foster. And as your honors are aware, self-defense obviously is an affirmative defense, and it's a complete one. If given and if agreed on by the jurors, the defense is justified in his killing of another. And because this is so, it's a high burden, understandably. However, the courts have stated that the bare fear of serious bodily injury, or even death, however well-grounded, is not enough. We would admit that. But there must also be some overt act indicative of imminent danger at the time. So based on that, it is our position that the determination of the ultimate justification for the killing of Ms. Cheatham in this case should have been an issue for the jury. In this case, Ms. Cheatham, and there's a lot of backstory as you read in the record, but Ms. Cheatham came to that hotel or motel in Madison Heights at 4:08 a.m. for a specific reason. She wasn't pressured, coerced, lured, abducted, or anything like that. And as I said in my brief, or as I stated in my brief, Ms. Cheatham was at that Madison Heights motel with Mr. Cheatham, her husband, because she wanted to be there. Upon arriving, she demanded $3,000 from the defendant. The record explains, and the briefs explain, that he came into a large amount of money from a workers' compensation settlement. So she demanded money from him. He refused. She became angry, and she told the defendant to go get cigarettes out of her car. She had parked outside the motel, and this is a motel, it's not a hotel. So at this time, when he leaves the motel room, she's left alone in the room with her purse and whatever was inside her purse. Could have been a gun, could have been a knife, could have been a variety of weapons. When he returned to the room, again, admittedly, this is all his statement. Sadly, she's dead, and he's the only one there. But when he returned to the room, the defendant notices that his wife, Ms. Cheatham, is on the bed with a blanket over her lap. So he comes back after had some sort of argument. He comes back in the motel room, and she's on the bed with a blanket over her lap. The arguing continues, and according to the defendant, his wife pulls the blanket off her legs and points a gun in his face. At this time, this was our argument, at this time, an argument can be made that the defendant was justified in killing her right then. So if he had a gun in a small motel room where there's a history and where there was fighting that night and where they're going through some sort of, where they're going through a divorce, if she pulls a gun on him in that room, if he had one, he could kill her then. These aren't the facts of the case. If he had a knife, he could quickly stab her right then.
The counsel, he knocked, by his own statement, he knocked the gun out of her hand, correct?
That's correct.
So, which is reasonable in light of the fact she had a gun, he knocked the gun out of her hand. Why does that not end his reasonable fear? And why wouldn't he go secure the gun?
And that's a great question, and that was our point. He did try to defuse the situation. I mentioned that he could have at that point if he had a gun shoot right then, or stab, or do whatever, but he didn't. He goes to his bag that he brought. He's a felon, so he doesn't have a gun, or he's not supposed to have a gun. But he goes and gets a nightstick, and you're right, he smacks the gun out of her hand. And that was the trial judge's rationale, or reasoning. As soon as the gun leaves her hand because of him striking her hand, the threat ends. It's over. It's done. You can't do anything about it. But I would submit, or we would submit, that the threat and his right to do something about that threat should last a little bit longer. Because, again, we're a...
What law supports that, though?
Well, the law of self-defense. Any reasonable fear of bodily injury. And again, we're in a small motel room where the gun's on the ground, and we can sort of picture the parties just sort of sitting there staring at each other. Who's going to do what next? Well, I think it's in his right, because she's pulled the gun on him before, seconds earlier, and because it's sort of been a pattern, that he doesn't have to wait till she picks it up and does something again.
And why wouldn't the reasonable action be to attempt to secure the gun rather than literally bashing someone's skull immediately thereafter?
Well, because it's you know, the record isn't exactly clear, but it could have been closer to her. It could have been closer to her.
But if the record isn't clear on that, how does that support your position?
Well,
he doesn't say, even by his own story, he doesn't say, I knocked the gun out of her hand, but it was so close to her, I was scared she could get to it before I did. Or I tried to get to it, and she was closer, so I had to hit her again. Instead,
well,
I just lost it.
Right. And he did say, I just lost it. And I think the Commonwealth has mentioned that. But he does say he lost it, and qualifies that with, I thought she was going to kill me. So in his mind, subjectively, that threat was still there. Even though the gun wasn't in her hand anymore, even though he didn't have a gun or anything like that.
So even assuming that we look at his, say that he still thought she was going to kill him, however irrational that was in light of the fact that he had knocked the gun away from her, where is the evidence that supports she was going to kill him at that point?
Well, the evidence, and all we have, is his statements that he made to the police and in the actual testimony that he thought that, and that she had actually made threats to him, and that she had a gun. The Commonwealth obviously doesn't believe that, but that's where we're at. Again, it's we're arguing for the jury instructions. That
are you arguing for both? Just it's still on appeal at this point. Are you arguing for an instruction on justifiable self-defense and excusable self-defense?
Yes.
You know, normally, it's easier to get the one on excusable self-defense, but help me understand how, under what you allege are the facts here, there would be one on excusable self-defense.
Well, let me clarify. My thought, or my hope, is to get an instruction on self-defense, defending without fault.
That would be justifiable, right?
So,
what was the proffered jury instruction? Was it both?
I believe that was it. I printed the copy because I thought that's actually might have been in the appendix. So my thought was, and this the instruction, and I wasn't trial counsel, but if you believe that the defendant was without fault in provoking or bringing on the fight difficulty, you further believe that he reasonably feared, under the circumstances as they appeared to him, that he was in imminent danger of bodily harm, and he used no more force under the circumstances as they appeared to him, that was reasonably necessary to protect himself from the perceived harm, the subjective perceived harm.
And that was the only one,
right?
The justifiable self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're making the argument, and Judge Humphrey's made the comment that you're sort of stretching it last time, but we're asking for a little bit longer, precisely because once that gun's knocked out, and I made the comment, you know, offhand, that they're sort of just, and we don't know what they were doing, but they're sort of just kind of there in a small room staring at each other, that he should have the benefit, or at least have the benefit of the jury determining if he did in fact have the right to defend himself. And yet the medical examiner opined, testified, that there were about five blows, and she doesn't know which one of the blows could have killed Ms. Cheatham. So in theory, the first blow to Ms. Cheatham could have killed her, just as the fifth blow could have. But he's really only taking one more swing than everyone here thought he should have, possibly. No one's really disagreeing with the fact that he had the right, with self-defense, to hit her with in the hand with the baton. It's just the next hit. That's really what we're trying to figure out. Again, we're trying to figure out, or we're asking the court to allow the jury, based on all that evidence, to make some sort of determination whether he was justified in doing it.
Just want to let you know you're entering your rebuttal time, but you may proceed if you wish.
I think I'll stop there, if that's all right.
Mr. Davis. Mr. Anderson, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I can make one or two quick points before I move on to the more fundamental things. One, I don't think either today or in brief the defendant, the argument in any way implicates his grand larceny conviction, because obviously once he beat her brains in, there's whatever self-defense rationale there is for that hardly extends to taking the car. So I think the grand larceny conviction is just simply not an issue here. Second, I don't think the counsel asked, if Judge Fields asked, if he was saying that there should have been instructions on both justifiable and excusable homicide. I think the answer was yes. There are two. He also wasn't sure whether both versions of self-defense were submitted to the jury. Page 32, excusable homicide was in fact proffered but refused. But there are two problems with him now saying that the trial court should have granted one on excusable homicide. One, when the matter of the self-defense instructions came up and most of the talk was about justifiable, and the court says, well, on the excusable one, I don't say a retreat here, which of course is one of the requirements for excusable homicide. But if you want to offer any argument on it, go ahead. There's no argument, which I take as an acquiescence to the court getting it right that there's no evidence here of retreat, and therefore, whatever else you want to say, there's no plausible argument of excusable homicides. Second, I note that in the brief of the defendant, he refers to self-defense. He defines the elements of justifiable homicide. There's no definition given of excusable homicide. I think that is very telling. I mean, if he thought that there was a good argument here for excusable homicide having been granted, the failure to define it the way he did justifiable homicide seems inexplicable. Moving on to the more basic issues in the case.
Can I ask you before you do, Mr. Anderson, on the question of the justifiable self-defense instruction? What authority evidence do you have to support your position that appellant was at least slightly at fault before the attack on his wife?
Remember, you only have to be slightly at fault, as your honors indicated. Well, I think to some degree you cannot divorce what happened in the motel room with the many months leading up to it. I mean, the evidence was that this wife, who was at wit's end, simply wanted him to sign the divorce papers so she could be done with this very unhappy marriage. In fact, he had a letter in his wallet at the time he was arrested a couple of weeks later in Wilmington, North Carolina, where she's just basically beseeching him to sign it so she can move on with her life. And by his own testimony on cross, he essentially was offering one excuse after another as to why he hadn't yet signed the divorce paper and why that wasn't happening. So she comes there with this as the backdrop, and they get into this argument. By his own description, there's an argument. I think if he only had to be slightly at fault, I submit all of those things in their totality constitute slightly at fault. But that's certainly, well, one of my arguments, certainly not at the top of the list. Although, if the court agrees he's at least slightly at fault, that's the end of the justifiable homicide angle. He simply didn't. His own actions disentitled him to such
instruction. How far can you look back?
Well,
at that totality.
That's not entirely clear. But if the court wants to say right now we're taking that off the table, I still submit the Commonwealth plainly should win this case, essentially for the reasons the single judge cited in his order refusing the petition, and to some degree Judge Decker has picked up on that. His own testimony shows that he wasn't entitled to a justifiable self-defense instruction. I went through it last night and I just jotted down his own testimony at various pages. He says, for example, at page 612, he claimed that, at least in his trial testimony, she pulled out a gun twice, and it was after the second time that he struck her hand and the gun fell out. By the way, when we just backing away a little bit on this notion of what is more than a scintilla of evidence, I cited this case, this court's decision in Brandau, and the court basically says it's a case-specific inquiry, and you have to look at the credible evidence. The Supreme Court of Virginia's decision in the death penalty case of Porter is a good example of that. There, the defendant who had been convicted of the capital murder of a police officer in the performance of his duties and given the death penalty argued he should have been given an instruction, I think it was on second-degree murder, it was either second-degree murder or voluntary manslaughter, because according to the defendant's own testimony, the officer had unexpectedly grabbed his arm and then pulled out a service revolver, at which point he panicked and shot him. And certainly would have been an easy enough conclusion to say that's more than a scintilla of evidence to warrant the instruction. The Supreme Court of Virginia rejected the argument, saying the only support for that was this implausible, discredited account of the defendant. So I think we have to consider all of that in terms of figuring out what is a scintilla, more than a scintilla of evidence here. But here, just a few of the highlights, so to speak, of the defendant's testimony. He said that he'd gone outside to get cigarettes, and he happened to have the nightstick or club in his bag, which is what he used to hit her. And by the way, he said he had the nightstick because he, at that point, could not legally possess a gun, and I guess was supposed to believe he was very legally fastidious about adhering to these restrictions on what other people could do. So for that reason, he didn't have a gun, although he somehow picks up the gun when he leaves. And then the gun, as the Commonwealth pointed out in closing argument, the gun would have been potentially his manna from heaven, saying, well, of course, this was the gun she threatened me with, and I thought she was going to kill me with. And he says he threw the gun away along with the nightstick, so his best possible chance to corroborate his account goes out the window, literally. That's very, very peculiar the whole way around, and it goes again to this notion of what's more than a scintilla. But be that as putting aside all that, just focusing solely on his own testimony, he says at page 612 of the appendix, this is after he started to open the bag and give her money, but then he gets the nightstick out and hits her hand. He says, what's she doing with the gun at that point? She's still got it in her hand. Okay, is she pointing it at you or doing something else with it? No, she had it in her hand. He says that at page 612. And yet, at page 686, when he says, that he hit her with the stick. He says, so you hit her in the hand with this club, is that what you're saying? Yes, ma'am. And her hand was pointed to you? Yeah, pointed in my face. That is about as material a discrepancy on a critical part of this chain of events as one could imagine. It's unexplained, but it certainly goes to the credibility of his account. He also says, after he hit her hand, this is page 616, or page 613, he says, I hit her hand first, and then the gun fell to the floor. He says at 616, after he hit her hand, quote, I started hitting everywhere. He says at page 618, when I hit her, she fell back. Page 628, 29, he hit her in the head after he hit her hand because, quote, I lost control of myself. Page 675, I blacked out and lost control. He says at page 690, after he hit her in the hand and then on the head, she tried to put her hand up and he hit it again. Now, under the Commonwealth's evidence, obviously, this is obviously not a case of self-defense of any sort because the Commonwealth's evidence was she was asleep. Commonwealth's evidence was she typically slept on her back. She often had her hands on her head. She had this scarf. And this is very important. The medical evidence indicated that the blow to her hand, which surely was her gun hand, I mean, I'm right-handed. If I'm on one of those many occasions I'm threatening someone with a gun, I'm not going to pick up my left hand and say, okay, that's simply contrary to human experience. So she's obviously using her gun hand to threaten him, according to him.
Was there evidence she was right-handed?
No, but I think the common sense inference is that you if you're threatening someone, you're doing it with your gun hand. I mean, any other inference seems strange at best. But so the evidence is she's threatening him with the gun. Then by his own description, he hits her on the hand. The medical evidence is it broke two fingers. So she has two broken fingers, the gun falls to the ground, and yet we're supposed to believe that at that point there's sufficient threat to him where, one, he was legally authorized to bash her head in 5 or 6 times. Any one of those blows could have been lethal. And two, he wasn't required. He claimed he somehow had a second set of keys to the Sonata. I don't think there was ever any evidence that two sets of keys were found in North Carolina. But that he somehow is not required to go outside and get in the car and get out of Dodge. I point out the Supreme Court of Virginia decision in Avent, which is somewhat analogous, where the defendant goes to the home of someone else, and the person at that home starts the series of events that leads to the homeowner's death. He hits the victim several times with his fist. Then he goes upstairs. Then the defendant goes upstairs, and he ends up killing him in a fairly similar fashion to what happened here. He beat his brains in. And the Supreme Court of Virginia said he could not properly invoke self-defense because there was an available car nearby outside and he didn't take advantage of that. Instead, he chose to go upstairs. And I think that's very much resembles what we have here.
Mr. Anderson, maybe this is a question that I should better direct at Mr. Davies, but how, from your perspective, are we to square the defendant's statement, I thought she was going to kill me, as if she represents an ongoing threat to him once he's knocked the gun from her hand, with I lost control of myself?
Let me put it this way, Your Honor, and to some degree I go back to Porter. Once he smashes her hand with the nightstick, again, assuming this alternative universe is true, that he didn't simply beat the brains out of her while she was asleep with her hands up here, which he often did lying on her back. Let's assume somehow that's totally not what happened, and that his version, at least to some degree, is along the lines of what did happen. We know from his own description he hits her hand with his nightstick to the point the gun drops to the ground. We know from the medical evidence that was with such force that she, two fingers on her hand were broken. I submit just that it's just not reasonable to, there's no reasonable fear of death or imminent harm under those circumstances. Also, if he had a second set of keys, which he apparently knew he did because he used them to take the car, he certainly, one, could have retrieved the gun, or two, in the alternative, could have fled outside and driven away. Again, she had two broken fingers. He says, however, despite all of that, he then loses control and bashes her in the head. He lost control. At that point, that was not necessary. Let me put it in different terms. Suppose he'd been convicted of assault and battery based on smashing her fingers. I think a self-defense theory would have a whole lot more relevance there, because then he could say, I struck her hand because she was holding the hand and I had to do something to make sure she didn't shoot me. But that's not what he was convicted of. He was convicted of first-degree murder, whereas the single judge found, and as his testimony plainly reflected, he hit her hand with great force, drops the gun, and under those circumstances, the non-injured person surely is in a better position to get the gun and or flee with his second set of keys. He didn't do it, bashed her in the head. All of that's sufficient to show that there was no valid self-defense claim to be had here.
Mr. Anderson, if I can ask for the indulgence of my colleagues while the time is up, could I ask you please to address the Commonwealth's perspective? Obviously, we know what's on brief. Briefly about the leading questions.
I think there were one or two questions. It's very hard to see how they were not leading, or how what the ruling would have been denying the leading instruction objection. I'll say several things, though. The inmate's non-challenged testimony plainly showed what the evidence otherwise plainly showed, including the defendant's own testimony, which is there was very bad blood. The defendant was very angry at his wife. He threatened her. He was extremely upset about what she supposedly was doing with his money and using this new car not to help his mother for doctor's appointments, not to go to the jail to visit him. In other words, he said she basically was stiffing him right and left, which of course goes to show, you know, he had a motive to do what he ended up doing. But there's simply not enough there in terms of what he was permitted to say to show that there was any prejudice sufficient to warrant reversal. One quick thing on that. He testified on direct that the defendant made noises about trying to lure her somewhere where he'd do harm to her. It was on the defendant's, I think, recross that the matter of situation, where would that have been? So a motel. That's a whole lot more damaging than the other, and that's something that's chargeable to the defendant. I submit the record in its totality plainly shows that at worst, any error here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and that this should not be the first case in however many decades to warrant reversal on that ground alone.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Davies, you have your rebuttal time, and I'll give you a little bit of extra time too.
Good. I'm going to start with the leading issue. Counsel mentioned that despite what was asked and despite what was answered, defense counsel recrossed and sort of made it worse. I would submit he made it worse only because he was trying to rehabilitate his client after the leading question was overruled. I mean, but for that overruling, there wouldn't be no testimony at all about the lure.
I guess the question I've got about that, and to kind of address what Mr. Anderson was saying, you know, the question was almost an open-ended question of soliciting evidence that wasn't already in the record as opposed to impeaching someone on the testimony they'd given over objection.
Specifically, what do you think about the that? Motel?
Yes, sir, because it was just, it was certainly not a leading question designed to impeach. It was simply soliciting evidence or information about where the supposed luring was.
Understood. I think my argument is but for, you know, the earlier objection being overruled, he didn't even have to go there, and he possibly didn't go there the right way. So once it's, you know, once that question's allowed, there are 12 people staring at him, and he's trying to, you know, trying to make his client seem a little better. But that he shouldn't even have to do that in the first place. And I would submit it's not harmless. You know, nowhere in the Commonwealth's briefs does it say it wasn't leading, I don't think. But they say it's just harmless. But again, you know, these questions about luring his wife to a motel, you know, again, these 12 people are sort of listening to the evidence that they were on the phone for 3 hours, that she stopped at a Quickie Mart and bought cigarettes, chicken, and coffee. And, you know, they're hearing that, but then later they're hearing that, you know, this is part of this grand scheme of him, of his, to get her there. So I think without the luring comments, she's there on her own, and she's there to distress money, she's there to distress the marriage. She's there possibly, you know, with a gun to demand money like he said she did. And I think it lessens it, makes it more likely that the jury would be leaning towards some other charge. I mean, again, we can't go inside the mind of the jury, but, you know, they're looking at the case. Perhaps they were leaning towards second degree or voluntary manslaughter or something, but for that luring evidence. So I think it's not harmless. And if the Commonwealth didn't ask those leading questions, I think we possibly could be looking at different results. And again, this case doesn't, these issues don't exist in a vacuum. They kind of go together. The Commonwealth even makes the argument for self-defense that it's, even if it is an error, it's harmless, because the jury had the option to convict on first degree, second degree, voluntary, and the fact that they chose to convict only of first degree and not second degree or voluntary strongly infers or implies that they didn't believe the self-defense argument, otherwise they would have done that. But self-defense and first degree murder are not mutually exclusive. You can have an intentional killing, a malicious killing, a willful, deliberate, premeditated killing in self-defense. So the fact that there was no instruction could have definitely influenced them. They could have been stuck between this, well, he did it on purpose, he had time, he premeditated. There was the second, it wasn't voluntary, there's no heat of passion. And, you know, they're looking between first and not guilty. If they don't have a self-defense instruction, they're only left with first degree. So the fact that they didn't have self-defense, I think, wasn't harmless there. If they had that instruction, they could have given them the benefit of the doubt. And if there wasn't leading questions from Joe Eddie Bennett, perhaps together those things would have ended up differently. And I would just conclude, or at least try to point out that there was some talk even now about,
yes, you may. I gave Mr. Anderson some extra time, so you may.
Thank you. You know, the Porter case is mentioned, I think, in response to the fact that the defendant, you know, is the only one really saying what happened. Because, like I said, sadly, the victim's dead. And she's the only other person in the motel room. And we're sort of inferring again that whatever he's saying is self-serving, and it didn't really happen. She was sleeping, and he beat her to death while she was sleeping. They mentioned the Porter case to say that that's not more than a scintilla of evidence. Just the defendant saying it happened isn't enough. I think in the Porter case, there was a police officer, so there's another person there. In this case, I think we can distinguish it, because it's just the defendant, and now a person who's dead. And so if he's saying she had a gun, I mean, we can kind of guess or speculate or come up with some sort of conjecture that he's just lying or making it up just to help himself. But he told the same story to the police officers when they interviewed him. He didn't change his story. He said he threw it in a river and no one found it. You know, that's probably hard to do. But no one's really disproved what he said. Again, the injuries to her hand could have been when she had the gun. Could have been when she was sleeping, but he's saying it didn't happen. So I think we sort of have to give the defendant some benefit, even though he's a defendant, even though he has motive to lie.
May I ask you the same question I did ask Mr. Anderson, because I think it probably is more appropriately directed at you, and that's, how are we to square the defendant's testimony? Number one, I thought she was going to kill me, as if she represented an ongoing threat to his life after he knocks the gun out of her hand, with I lost control of myself and then bashed the brains in,
right. Literally.
I mean, how are we to believe that he was forming, even processing the thought that she could still represent an ongoing threat to him if he says I lost control of myself and then went to her head, basically?
I mean, that's a good question. I guess, you know, 99% of every conversation is context. We know, or we think we know, what lost control means. I would maybe point out that maybe it meant something different to him. Maybe it meant he was just excited. Maybe it means he wasn't thinking entirely clearly. But despite that, nonetheless, he did say she still posed a threat to him, and he acted, even in that state, as he thought he should have acted. It's a difficult question, but that should be resolved in that manner.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. We appreciate your argument. We will greet counsel. And then